The Sinfonia No. 1 by Johann Rosenmüller, played there by Jordi Savall and Hesperian 20.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn, broadcasting out of Henry Ford Community College, and thank you for tuning in on this beautiful classical day. You know, if you'd like to learn more about the exciting happenings at the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra, well, I've got some news for you. Mark your calendar for Friday, November 14th. It's next performance of the 2008-2009 season of the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra, and this performance is entitled Heroic Journeys. It will be wonderful, I guarantee it. Again, Friday, November 14th, next performance of the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra. And don't forget that free half-hour pre-concert talk by your host, Jim Walters, offering a fascinating insight into the evening's music. It's a great package. It's a reasonable opportunity to see this gem of an organization in our own backyard. For details or for tickets, contact the box office 313-565-2424. That's 565-2424.
Good morning. This is Lynn, and I am welcoming you to the new Forum Shows. It's the second Saturday of the month, and we are presenting two 30-minute episodes of the Sierra Club radio show. And it's entertaining, but it's also a useful collection of ideas and issues. It can all make our lives a little bit better, and Sierra Club has a great reputation for working with environmental issues, starting right now.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with singer-songwriter Dar Williams. We'll also speak with Pauli Ojea from Breast Cancer Action about their Think Before You Pink campaign and why they're targeting Yoplait yogurt. Finally, we'll talk with John Bela, who helped to design the organic Victory Garden in front of San Francisco's City Hall. We're here now with singer-songwriter Dar Williams, who just released her seventh studio album, Promised Land. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
It's great to have you on the show. You know, we hear that environmental issues are very important to you. And I'm curious to hear, did you have a eureka moment when you realized you wanted to get involved? Or was it just something that was part of your life for a long time?
It was definitely a big part of my life. And I even, when I was first touring, like I had this thought in my mind of, I'd never want to get so famous that I don't have an opportunity to compost and recycle. You know, like I was a very earnest person in my early 20s, and so it was always there. And then when I first became solvent, actually one of the first places I joined was the Sierra Club and some other environmental nonprofits. And I was, so suddenly I had this influx of information about the planet. And I became even more obsessed. And I guess one eureka moment was when a journalist said, so are you interested in any causes? And I'd just been touring with Joan Baez, and I thought, how is it not clear to the world that, you know, environmental, social justice, but that whole gamut is important to me. So I got out, you know, I got my butt out there. And I started doing fundraisers for the things that were important to me, and then over time sort of pared it down to the most, the places where I thought I could do the most good and that were the most passionate for me.
You know, a lot of musicians and singer-songwriters live in big cities like New York or Los Angeles. You've made some different choices. Tell us a little bit about your lifestyle and how that relates to some of your green ethics.
Actually, it's where I had the space to write and to live. I used to live in Boston, but I moved out to Western Massachusetts where there was, where the rents were cheaper. I mean, this is when I was first starting out, and I just needed space and time. And I need to get out of the rat race. So that was a great move, and I was surrounded by people who were making connections between social justice issues and environmental issues, local food issues and environmental issues and things like that, because it's very rich farmland in Western Massachusetts. So that was a great place to jump off of for touring, and there is a way to be connected to the world. But it was a great foundation of green education. And then I moved to a beautiful town in upstate New York just because I thought it was beautiful and I didn't want to move to New York City. Then I did move to New York City with my husband for 3 years, and he said, let's not raise kids here. You know, just getting in the door was hard enough for one person, not with a baby stroller. So we moved out to a beautiful town on the Hudson River, and then I reconnected with a lot of my Hudson River causes, which felt like coming home.
Now, you've also mentioned that local foods and organic foods are an important issue for you. Tell us a little bit more about your involvement in that cause.
You know, I used to have a joke, like I could really put anything in my body, you know, that I ate plenty of junk food and stuff, but that I was concerned about how I ate for the planet. You know, it's just better if it's local, it's better if it's organic for the planet. You know, it's the web of life. I was like, I'm Scottish, you know, I can probably put anything in there, but looking at everybody else's, you know, what's really harming the world. Making a local food choice, like I would joke with my friends, it's like it's not going to bring down the big boxes to buy something that's made by an artisan or that to make a connection with a local farm, but it will help those entities, the artisans, the local farmers who are doing things right, make a living. So that's why you make those choices. And what I love is I go to a lot of communities where I see that the community is plugged in, and then I plug in with the people who get around that way in ways that help their communities, and that's good for my health, that's good for them, it makes me feel connected as I travel. So that's how that sort of connection to the food thing evolves. But really, it's how we make food and how we put it out there and how we feed ourselves as a planet has become kind of an obsession for me.
Well, you mentioned looking at some of these issues locally in the communities where you tour. And you also started something called the Echoes Initiative as a way of giving back to the local nonprofits and places where you are touring. So tell us a little bit more about that.
That was something that actually my manager said, you know, you have this song called Echoes. It's by some friends of mine. It's a beautiful song, and it's all about how every little thing that you do echoes all over the world. And it's really, you know, it feels good to sing it. It feels good to perform it. And he said, an echo can be a very small thing at first. And you're always happier when a friend calls you up and gets you involved with a small fundraiser, a local thing, where you can do a lot of good for a little organization. And so why don't we seek out those things? And on this one tour for that album, let's really focus on these places where maybe we can raise $1,000 and they can table and they can come up for 1 minute, which sounds a little mean, but actually it's perfect. You know, just 1 minute to tell the audience who they are. And all of these people came up on stage from all these different cities and just poured out their feelings and precise explanations of what they were doing. And it was so cool. It was the best part of the whole tour. And what that branched into for me, I don't do the Echoes Initiative per se, but I really fell in love with community garden projects. So I think that the next thing I do on a large scale will be involved with community gardens, because it just seems like that's where there's so much people power.
Now, we also hear that you have been working to get your town's middle school to look at geothermal power as an option. What got you involved in that issue, and how is that campaign moving along?
Recently, we just had a nice turn. Somebody wrote and said, you know, the boilers are going down, and we have geothermal experts here in our little village, and it looks like that school is in a prime location to be involved. And so we had a meeting at our house and talked about it, and it just seemed like, in that one room, and this happens, I mean, this happens in California, I'm sure, a lot, but, you know, it was really nice to see it in our little village. We have geothermal experts who are right on hand to say exactly how this new technology worked, how it's been around forever, how it'd be great, and that we needed some people to do some publicizing and some fundraising, and I was like, well, I'm on that part of it. And then, you know, other people said, you know, we got some wonderful people organizing the big sale, and somebody else totally stepped forward for the silent auction, and other people were filming it. And the bagpipes, we have this great Highland pipe band, and they came and sang on the band song, The Wait, with the Highland pipes. And we had some high school musicians come in with their band. And so it turned into this kind of everybody having something to offer to raise the visibility and understanding of this thing that really is, at the end of the day, the conventional energy use of the future, but just needed a little extra spotlight and care. So I was sort of the glittery element of it. You know, I was the shiny thing to get people to come to the concert. But everybody, you know, they started a website. They got a lot of education out there. And the school board went on with it, and they were lovely. And they said, if you can, you know, this state agency will raise half the money. If you actually raise the other half of the money, then we can get this study done. But, you know, we're broke right now. So, yeah, if you could do that, that would be great. And we raised $15,000. And the study has just been proposed, and they're going to take, you know, for the money that we raised with the state. And they're going to go forward so that the town sees how viable it is, and then they can vote on it. And hopefully we can put that sort of the education saying, yes, it costs more up front, but the fuel will cost nothing. So it will really be the same as if we replaced the boilers.
Now, you tour and you play with a lot of other musicians. I know you've worked a lot with Joan Baez and many other singer-songwriters in the folk world. Give us the inside scoop. Who else is really interested in environmental issues? I know, I'm sure many folk musicians are, but anything you can tell us about some of the friends you've made along the way and any joint efforts that you've done with them?
You know, I enlist friends as I can, and it's different friends for different things. There was a library in Wellfleet that, which is on Cape Cod, that it was putting up a massive solar array, and I was about to, you know, write them a check, and I said, well, what if I give you some signed works, and what if I call up my friends who are authors and musicians? And there are some definite first phone calls for that, for people who will come through and send their CDs and their best wishes. And there's some really great, Chris Smither is a wonderful folk artist and a friend. But, you know, sometimes depending on if it's a New York City thing, you know, I wrote to Ani DeFranco once and I said, you know, I know you get a lot of requests, Ani, and we're friends and I don't want to push that, but if you play to Clearwater this year, they're sort of in deep water. Clearwater is what Pete Seeger started to basically save the Hudson River, which happened. I said, their festival really needs someone like you to come. And if you came, you would possibly save them. And she came, and they made an extra $80,000 that year on the festival, and she saved the organization. And the Indigo Girls said, well, we'll do it sometime. And after I was off the board of that organization, they came. They said, oh, we promised that we were going to come. So they came the next year. And I also wrote a letter early on to Natalie Merchant, who I don't know, asking her if she would do it. And she showed up with her band and totally just blew that festival away. So it's writing the right letter at the right time, not writing too many letters, and kind of knowing who does it, but also trying to get out of the envelope, you know, and talking to people who I know are personally really interested and are actually kind of flattered to be asked to be involved with, you know, something very specific, a community composting program, you know, thing. But so I just try to be as creative as I can and try to figure out how I can bring people in in ways that make them feel like it's really exciting and fun, find other musicians that they've always wanted to play with or something, and problem solve like that, as opposed to saying, okay, who are the usual suspects? Because you probably know who the usual suspects are.
So if you could tell your fans one thing that they should do to protect the environment or give them any advice about what they can do to really get involved, what would you tell them?
I would tell them to grow something. To hook into their local food scene. And, you know, we're starting to freeze more. I have not learned how to can. That's where I'm a touring artist and I'm a mother and I haven't learned how to can and I don't want to kill anybody, so I'm not doing that. But we have a garden with our neighbors, which is perfect because I'm away and when I'm home I can do it, when I'm not I can't. And so, but we had our lawn to offer, so we just turned that into this garden, and it's very meaningful to us. It gets you outside and meeting your neighbors, and then you're, you know, exchanging tips about your tomatoes and what to make with them, and suddenly the community, suddenly you're having a block party because what else are you going to do with that zucchini but make gazpacho and zucchini bread and share it, you know? So I would, you know, I've become really interested in all of the things that help me as a mother do things that are in keeping with the planet. Gardens, community gardens, farmers markets, and libraries, and it's made my life much better to really go local on those things. But I would say just grow some tomatoes. It's hard because in California, I think that, you know, it's the Garden of Eden and there's so much there. But for us in New York, if you're not growing it, there's a really good chance you're getting it from California. And that system just has to change fundamentally.
Well, it's really been great having you on our show. I've been a fan of your music for years, and I just am really impressed by how much you're doing to walk the walk. So thanks again for joining us.
I feel that way, but thank you. Thank you so much, Orly.
Well, you've been listening to Dar Williams, singer-songwriter who just released her 7th studio album, Promised Land. Joining us now in our studio is Pauli Ojea from Breast Cancer Action, here to talk about their Think Before You Pink campaign. Welcome.
Thank you, Orly. It's great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you here again. I know we were here last year talking about the same issue, and I'm looking forward to hearing about some of the new work that you're doing. For our listeners who didn't hear our interview with you last year, let's start by talking a little bit about Breast Cancer Action, how your group is different from the other nonprofits that focus on breast cancer awareness.
Well, Breast Cancer Action is an education advocacy organization, And we believe we need to move beyond awareness and towards action. And so what we do is try to engage people in the social and political issues that need to be addressed in order to end the epidemic. Some of the issues that we work on are, for example, conflicts of interest at the FDA, environmental links to breast cancer, and inequities in breast cancer. The other thing that I think kind of makes us stick out a little bit from the crowd is that we are the only national breast cancer organization that doesn't take money from pharmaceutical companies, doesn't take money from big polluters like oil and chemical companies. And that's because we don't want to take money from anyone who's benefiting from cancer, making a profit off of it, or contributing to it in some way. And that keeps us independent and it keeps us able to say the truth as we see it.
And of course, you're one of the groups that's out there saying, let's not just raise awareness that breast cancer is a problem, but let's look at those root causes and let's look at the environmental causes and the chemical causes. And I think that's really important.
Exactly. That's definitely something that needs more public attention and more attention from the government and corporations as well.
Right, because we can fight it on a few fronts. We can obviously find treatments and search for a cure, but we do know that there are chemicals that are bad and we should be getting rid of them now. And that brings us to talk about the Think Before You Pink campaign. So tell us about that.
The Think Before You Pink campaign is a campaign that asks for transparency and accountability on the part of companies that sell products in the name of breast cancer. Right now it's October and you might know that it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month because you go to the grocery store and you'll see pink on lots of different products. Lots of products are being sold. So we want these companies who are selling these products to be more transparent and we want them to be more accountable. And one of the ways they could be more accountable is that they could try to do their best to make sure that if they're selling something in the name of breast cancer, that that product is a healthy product, that it's not somehow causing the disease. And we have a lot of examples of products and or companies that we call pink washers, and we kind of took that from the environmental movement with greenwashing. But these are products that are sold in the name of breast cancer, but that contain ingredients that might be linked to the disease. Examples would be cosmetics companies that are selling cosmetics with a pink ribbon on them, and yet they have nasty chemicals in them like parabens and phthalates. Another big example that we're focusing on this year is Yoplait yogurt. And many people have probably seen the pink lidded tops of Yoplait yogurt. And they give money to a breast cancer organization when you lick the lid and send it in. The problem is that their yogurt is made with milk from cows that have been injected with recombinant bovine growth hormone, or RBGH. And the use of RBGH has a lot of health concerns around it. Breast cancer is just one of them.
Well, how widespread is RGBH? Is it in many of the mainstream yogurts that are out there?
That's a really good question. The use of RBGH is actually going down in this country, and it's estimated that only about 15 to 17% of cows are actually injected with it. It's also banned in a lot of other countries, all of the EU, Japan, Australia, Canada. But what that means is that if a company hasn't committed to being RBGH free, then some or a lot of their dairy products might still be using that. The good news is that there are some options out there. There's some companies that are making RBGH free products, but we think it should be all companies, and everyone should be able to walk into a store and have easy access to artificial hormone free dairy products.
So how has Yoplait responded so far to this campaign?
They've actually said that they don't really want to be getting milk that has RBGH in it either. Like, they kind of want RBGH to go away, and they know that the market is moving that way. But they've kind of just thrown their hands up. They haven't committed to telling their suppliers, no, we aren't going to use milk that's been treated with RBGH. So I think that there is more that they could do, and I think that they do have a lot of power being such a big company. And again, other huge corporations have done it. So I know that Yoplait and General Mills can do it too.
Now, all these companies that are using the pink ribbon for their marketing, how much of a difference does that make? I mean, I wonder sometimes how much money are they really contributing? Where is that money going? Is it worth it for people to even send in the tops of their yogurt lids? I don't know. What do you think?
That's a really great question. And again, I think people have to ask those things when they see a pink ribbon on a product. this is what Think Before You Pink, our program, really looks at, is how much money is going and where is it going and what kind of difference is it going to make. In the case of Yoplait, you would need to eat 3 yogurts a day for the 4 months that the campaign is running in order to make a $36 contribution. Some people might say, okay, that's enough. And some people might think, well, maybe I should just write a check. And clearly, if we're concerned about the health impact of that yogurt, that's another thing to think about. I also think that, you know, something that we talk about in relation to this campaign is that sometimes I think people are sort of lulled into complacency when they see that there's all of this pink around, where they see that there's all these things that they can buy in order to make a difference. And the problem of breast cancer hasn't been solved, and it's not going to be solved by shopping. So we really want people to do something besides shop and think about how they can become politically engaged on this issue.
And anything else that they can do to get involved on your website? Do you have other, you know, things people can do to take action?
Absolutely. We have monthly email alerts that tell people about ways that they can take action on our issues, like environmental health issues or inequities or FDA advocacy. And we have a lot of really great information about breast cancer on our website as well. So we encourage people to get informed, tell their friends, and be informed consumers.
Thanks so much. It's been great having you on the show. You've been listening to Pauli Ojea from Breast Cancer Action, talking about their Think Before You Pink campaign. Joining us now in our studio is landscape architect and garden designer John Bela. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Well, John, we had you on our show a while ago to talk about Parking Day, and now you'll be wearing a different hat talking about the Victory Garden that was recently planted in front of San Francisco City Hall.
Yes, indeed.
So tell us how you first got involved in that project.
Well, it started when Slow Food Nation, which is a branch of Slow Food Organization in the U.S., approached me about being part of their Design Advisory Council. And at that time, they suggested that we, in addition to doing the Slow Food event, we do a series of dinners in the neighborhoods, sort of taking over public spaces, working with a community, with a chef, with a food producer, and really doing a set of neighborhood dinners, sort of like you see at the Palio in Siena before the races. That idea sort of fell apart. It was too ambitious. We wanted to do 15 dinners. But instead, the Slow Food folks suggested or talked about holding their event, which recently passed, in two locations, Civic Center and at Fort Mason. And one of the folks at Slow Food suggested that we do a garden at Civic Center. And initially, the idea was about doing a temporary garden, maybe bringing in some planter boxes. And I said, you know what? We can do a lot better than that. There's actually a great historic precedent for a fully functional, productive garden right in front of City Hall, which was there in 1943. And I learned about this first Victory Garden through the work of artist and designer Amy Franceschini, who's created something called the San Francisco Victory Gardens Program, which is really about reinventing and recreating this Victory Gardens movement to meet contemporary needs. And so,
because we had a thriving movement here during World War II.
It was a thriving movement. We produced 40% of the food that was consumed was produced within the city boundaries. And what we've seen today is that that sort of programming isn't as active. You know, the idea of using urban green space for food production has a little bit of fallen off the radar. I mean, other cities who have more vacant space, there's a much more active urban gardening happening. Philadelphia, Detroit, Boston, but in San Francisco, since the collapse of SLUG, which was the main sort of organizing force for urban gardening, there's been a bit of a vacuum here in San Francisco. And so I teamed up with Amy, and I actually suggested to the folks at City Hall that we do a permanent garden right there, right in front of City Hall, to grow food for the San Francisco Food Bank.
Now, what was the reaction like from City Hall when this idea was proposed?
Well, initially,
let me fill our listeners in who are not familiar with San Francisco Civic Center. There's a big open plaza there, a beautiful big open space right in front of City Hall. And, you know, putting a Victory Garden right in the middle of it is obviously very visual. People will notice it.
Yes. Initially, the folks in City Hall said, hey, can we do this somewhere else? Maybe we could do a permanent garden in another part of the city. But I think we understood that the symbolic power of that location was really crucial for the movement and to leverage the power of the idea to really build a whole network of these types of gardens throughout the city and throughout the country.
How much produce are you able to grow in an urban garden like this, just right in front of City Hall?
Well, we've been producing about 100 pounds a week, and that was at our peak harvest season, which was just a few weeks ago. It was a really interesting process transforming that patch of grass into a garden. We started with 10,000 square feet of turf, and working with teams of volunteers, 10 to 20 people a day, over the course of 2 weeks, we tore up that grass, we rolled it up, and we gave it away. And then we brought in topsoil and these rice straw wattle bed retaining logs. And then with a group of 250 people, we planted the garden out and put in about 3,000 seedlings that were grown by our partner organization, City Slicker Farms in West Oakland. About, 6 to 8 weeks following that initial planting, we started harvesting. And since then, we've been getting about 100 pounds a week.
Who does that food go to?
The food goes right to the San Francisco Food Bank. And we decided to partner with them because they have an excellent distribution network. They work with 60 to 80 meal programs throughout the city. They have an incredibly efficient warehouse. And so they either pick up our produce or we bring it to them. And within hours, it's already going out to folks in the community. We've had people come up and say, hey, I just tried some of the chard from the garden. I said, really? How did you manage to get that? And it's just, there's a really quick turnaround with the food bank. So they're a great partner in terms of getting, high quality local organic produce out to those who need it here in the city.
What kinds of produce were you growing besides chard?
Well, we grew chard, kale, collards, several types of beans, 15 types of lettuce. We've got tomatoes. We've got corn. We've got squash. We've got a whole herb garden. We've got a whole set of flowering plants and pollinating plants that attract beneficial insects. So it's really a sort of robust microecology there. It's a very small working farm. But as much as it's about the plants, it's really about the people. It was an interesting challenge for us to think about, okay, here we are right in front of City Hall, surrounded by some of the city's most powerful civic institutions, and yet we're steps away from the Tenderloin, which is one of the areas in the city which has the most homelessness and poverty. So will it work here? If we can grow food here, we can probably do it anywhere.
You're also a part of a program that's creating these victory gardens in people's backyards.
That's
Tell us a little bit more about that.
That's right. So we received a grant from the San Francisco Department of the Environment to do 15 backyard gardens. And these are basically starter garden kits, right? Two raised beds, a drip irrigation system, a set of seedlings. And it's really about helping people who want to grow food at home to save on food costs, to get started with it. And so we're able to do 15 gardens this year. We've already chose our recipients for this year, but we're hoping to get funding to expand the program next year.
How are people chosen, and if people are interested, how do they get on the list?
People can sign up on the website. It's sfvictorygardens.org, and we assembled a community jury to select the recipients. And basically, we were looking for a geographic diversity. We wanted a garden in every district. We wanted, social, ethnic diversity as well as income diversity. So we really cast a broad net, and we chose 15 recipients. The recipients sign a good gardening contract, so we know that they're going to commit to really making it work and also having the garden open and available for tours. And so it's really about getting people started with food producing at home.
Well, it's been great having you on the show today.
It's a pleasure, Orly.
Thanks for coming into our studio. Yeah. You've been listening to John Bela, landscape architect and garden designer, who designed the Victory Garden in front of San Francisco City Hall.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
You take your 6-year-old to the playground. You watch her go down the slide, then run over to the swings. Another mother strikes up a conversation. You take your eye off your daughter for just a few seconds. You look back at the swings. And she's gone. Your heart drops into your stomach. You jump up, your eyes searching. You cry out her name.
Lily? Lily?
From the top of the slide, you hear a voice.
Mommy, watch me!
Every parent knows that feeling. Imagine if she were actually abducted. Go to wirelessamberalerts.org. Sign up for free Amber Alerts on your cell phone. When an Amber Alert is issued in the areas you've chosen, you'll receive a free text message. If you spot the vehicle, the suspect, or the child described in the alert, call 911. Sign up today at wirelessamberalerts.org. a child is calling for help. This message brought to you by the Wireless Foundation, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Ad Council.
If you're thinking about going back to school or continuing your education, you should thank Henry Ford Community College. Since 1938, HFCC has provided excellence and innovation in education and services to their students and their community. Over the decades, thousands of students have gone on to become leaders in their fields, and now it's your turn. The winter semester begins Monday, January 12th, and registration is already taking place. Remember, Henry Ford Community College offers a job skills guarantee, a credit transfer guarantee, and a tuition freeze guarantee that guarantees that your tuition rates will be frozen if you graduate from HFCC within 4 years. Classes are filling up fast, so call 1-800-585-HFCC today or visit us online at www.hfcc.edu for more information. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice guaranteed.
Saturday at 10 a.m., tune in to one of our special forum shows on WHFR. Forum shows are locally produced talk shows on alternative topics not available elsewhere in Detroit radio. If you miss one of your favorite talk shows on WHFR, go to our website at whfr.fm. Look for the forum podcast link and click. Forum shows are now available to be downloaded anytime after broadcast. So remember to tune in every Saturday at 10 a.m. for one of our forum shows. And if you miss your favorite talk show, go to the website at whfr.fm.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. This week, we bring you the best of Sierra Club Radio. We replay some of our favorite interviews.
We'll talk with Lois Gibbs, the woman who fought to clean up the Love Canal community in upstate New York and now runs the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. And we're thrilled to have Arianna Huffington join us today, political commentator, founder of the Huffington Post, and author of a new book called On Becoming Fearless. 30 years ago, the citizens of Love Canal, New York, captured headlines around the country when they realized they were living on a secret toxic waste dump that was poisoning their families. One mother, Lois Gibbs, emerged as a hero who led the fight for justice and helped launch the anti-toxics movement in this country, the catalyst for laws like Superfund that make polluters pay to clean up their act. She joins us now from Washington, D.C., where she directs the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. So, Lois, Love Canal happened 30 years ago this year. And for our listeners who might not know the history, can you give us a quick snapshot of the story before we go more in depth?
Absolutely. Love Canal was a toxic, well, still is a toxic waste dump with 20,000 tons of chemicals that was located in the center of this blue-collar working-class community, my community. It was covered up with dirt. They built an elementary school on the periphery of it, and then everybody sort of walked away, and it took about 20 years for it to leak enough that it actually got into the homes and into the school playground and into the bodies of the residents who lived there. And as a former resident and mom, you know, I had lived there for 5 years and bought my house. Nobody told me about it. And then I learned about Love Canal from a newspaper when I picked it up, and it's like, oh my goodness, because my children were both sick at Love Canal, and I kept on trying to figure out what is wrong with them. Why are they so sick? I'm healthy. My husband's healthy. And when I read this newspaper article and saw that this thing causes seizures and this thing causes a blood disease, none of these chemicals, of which I could pronounce, of course, at that time, it sort of clicked for us. So that's sort of the short version. You know, it was a toxic waste dump. It leaked into the environment. It made people sick. And essentially, when we found out we were sick, we began to organize
and push to get relocation. There was no way that they could clean up Love Canal. And in fact, today, the dump is still there along the mighty Niagara River, just upstream of the Great Lakes, and is still leaking slowly into the river and into the lakes. And there's just no technology to fix that problem.
So when you first found out about this and you decided you wanted to do something, at the time, you didn't have any formal experience as an organizer or an activist.
No, I had no experience. And it was one of the scariest things I ever did. You know, it's like I kept waiting for somebody to come knock on my door and tell me. And I think that's where a lot of people are. It's like, come knock on my door, tell me what I'm going to do about what I just read in the newspaper and what I'm seeing in my own home with my sick kids. And nobody came knocking, and I decided I had to go find that door knocker, and all I had to do was go knock on a couple doors, and they would emerge. That was my thinking. But it was really scary. And we went door knocking, and we got people together, and none of us had had any experience. I mean, we were all organizing by the seat of the pants, and we believed back then, and I think people today still believe, that if there's a problem, if there's a chemical problem coming out of a factory next door or a dump site or in a product that your children are chewing on, that government, if they knew it, they would stop it. They would somehow, somebody in the decision-making process would stop that. And that's what we believed at Love Canal. So we went out and we did a health survey to prove that we were sick, and it was due to these leaking chemicals. And we showed that 56% of our children at Love Canal were born with birth defects. They had three ears, double rows of teeth, extra fingers, extra toes, or were mentally retarded. And when we presented this to the state health department, said, see, we're sick, just like people do all across the country. The health department said, well, actually, you know, we don't think you're sick. And later we pushed them to do a study. They confirmed our results. And they said, well, it's because of the Love Canal community is a random clustering of genetically defected people. Absolutely insane. It was absolutely insane because, you know, there's 20,000 tons of chemicals. These chemicals are detected in our home, in our soil, in our children's elementary school, and they're trying to say it's a random clustering. And so even today, 30 years later, we're hearing and seeing the same thing, and people just have to do what we did, is just organize and say, it's not about the science, although that's important. It's not about the law, because these companies actually do get permits or permission or licenses to pollute a certain amount, which allows a certain amount of human health, environmental, marine life, and wildlife damage. It's really about creating the political will to stop it.
Now, your community association had some very innovative and creative tactics for really bringing this issue to the fore. How did you finally convince the decision makers to relocate all of the families that had children who were most at risk?
Well, for the most part, one of the things we did is we were very good at planning. Governor Hugh Carey had said that pregnant women and children under two could be relocated in the first 239 homes that encircle the canal. But we knew that pregnant women and children under two were sort of like the canaries in the mine, and that everybody needed to be evacuated. So we really dogged him across the state, demanding that he gives us a face-to-face meeting so we can talk to him about this whole canary in the mine business. And he refused to do so. So we just kept after him and after him. And finally his people called up and said, okay, the governor will come. But he's not going to answer any questions. And so we kept dogging him and saying, no, we don't want that meeting until he's agreed to take a questions from the audience, which is our families. And he finally agreed. He came to Love Canal. And one of the things we did is we were very strategic, and I don't exactly know why. I think it was just instinctive. None of us were trained. And we decided that we only get one question. That's the only one the governor's going to allow us to ask. So we had to make that a really good question that we only could get the answer we wanted. And so we did a whole lot of planning for days and days and days. And in the end, we put together a great strategic plan. And I think this is how you create that political will I was talking about. So the governor was on an elevated stage, and he gave a campaign speech that almost convinced me to vote for him. When he got done, he quickly looked at his watch and said, I have time for one question. That's what we negotiated with his staff. And so I stood up. I was appointed to ask the question on behalf of the group. And he was looking for somebody else to raise their hand because he didn't want to call me. And he's looking around the audience, except for all around the audience, we sprinkled our folks. So anybody who put their hand up, somebody else would pull it down. So you would hear this, "Oh, ah, what are you doing? Don't touch me." It was really quite funny. And I'm standing there very, very strong, very proud, waiting for him to call on me, which he eventually did. And when he called on me, now he's running for re-election, and what do politicians want? They want to be, look good in front of their voters as it relates to family values and children and safety and stuff like that. So as I was giving an intro to the problems of Love Canal and the question, down the center aisle of Love Canal came 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old children dressed in their best. And these children did a semicircle around the podium. They were asked to fold their hands and put them down in front of them and look up at the governor. And so when all the children were in a semicircle, and they were also promised an ice cream cone if they were good, so they were working really hard here. So the children got in a semicircle and folded their hands and looked up at the governor. And when the children were in place, I asked the governor whether he was going to allow the 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds to remain at Love Canal and die. Now, a governor running for re-election, there's no way I have to study this. There's no way out of that question. We had explored all of them. And he said, "Oh, of course I am. In fact, I forgot. That's what I came here to tell you." And he went on to say he was going to evacuate all families in the first 239 homes, regardless of whether they were pregnant or had a child under 2. It was a major victory. Those families should have been evacuated without us having to do it. It should have been done because they were at risk. But the reality of not just Love Canal, but today, is that we have to make it politically advantageous for these politicians to do it, because it costs money, and it, you know, really doesn't shine nicely on large corporations.
You know, some have said that Love Canal was more than just a time or a specific event that occurred to one community 30 years ago. I've heard it described as the launch of a movement. Can you help us to understand a little bit more about what that means?
I think Love Canal was huge at educating the American people about toxic waste. Prior to Love Canal, most people thought that hazardous waste wasn't a problem, and if it was a problem, it was only in the workplace. And when Love Canal came on the front page of all newspapers across NBC Nightly News and 60 Minutes and Phil Donahue, and it got a lot of media play, that people started looking to see what was in their backyard, and people realized very, very quickly that maybe that smokestack or maybe that dump site really was responsible for the strange illnesses and other problems they were seeing in their community. And so when I left Love Canal 28 years ago, I left with 3,000 names of people in 3,000 different communities who wanted to do something. And from there, it moved to a much larger movement. The environmental justice movement, for example, came out of that as well. When we realized the people in the Northeast and the Midwest were becoming very smart about this, and they were blocking landfills and incinerators and shutting down nasty industries all in the Northeast and in the West Coast. And suddenly all of this toxics was not just disappearing, but it was actually moving south. And so you saw one community after another that was low income, that was rural, that was primarily a community of color, who were suddenly being dumped on. And so there was an environmental justice movement that evolved from there. And it's been a fabulous journey over the last 30 years in that this country has come forward leaps and bounds. Now, I know we have lots of problems, but through this journey, we have done so much since Love Canal.
Any other words of inspiration for our listeners out there who are fighting their own local battles?
Yeah, I think my biggest advice for people is stand your ground. Wherever your ground is, you know, people are saying, "Well, I need to deal with global warming and it's so big and it's so..." Just do something in your own backyard. That I think over the last 30 years we have shown with Right to Know, with Superfund, with styrofoam being phased out, with so many things that we've done. I mean, you can't build a hazardous waste commercial landfill in this country, and it's still legal. All the things that were done just by regular folk standing their ground in their community and saying, "What change can I make here? And how can I help?" Maybe by signing a letter from somebody or something, for the bigger picture, but what can I do here? Because if everybody cleans up their own backyard, it's like a mosaic. You know, that the mosaic will come together and we will have a healthier planet, healthier people, and healthier environment to live in and work and play and pray.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. Again, you've been listening to Lois Gibbs, the activist from the Love Canal events of 30 years ago, who today is the director of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. We're joined now by Arianna Huffington, political commentator, nationally syndicated columnist, and best-selling author. She has been nominated for an Emmy, ran for governor against Arnold Schwarzenegger, and is the founder of one of the nation's leading liberal blogs, The Huffington Post. Her latest book is called Becoming Fearless in Love, Work, and Life. Arianna, it's great to have you on the show.
It's great to be on the show.
Okay, well, election season is in full swing, so I think we should jump right in and start with politics. You know, you've been on both sides of the aisle, first as a very vocal Republican and later as someone who made the switch to progressive politics. So I'm wondering, how do you think we can push environmental issues to the fore of the political agenda this season for both parties?
Well, I think that there is something really significant happening right now, which is that the public has actually come to believe that global warming, the climate crisis is real. And the attempt by the right and by many in the media to make it appear as though there are two sides to the story has not worked. You know, I have a new book actually coming out in April called Right is Wrong, in which I have an entire chapter on the media's propensity to act as though every side, every story has two sides. So you would have theoretically, Al Gore on one side talking about the dangers of what's happening to our environment, and you would have Senator James Inhofe on the other side talking about how, in fact, global warming is a fraud, as he notoriously put it. And those two sides would be presented to the public as though they were equally valid. So it's very important, as this is shifting, as people are realizing that there aren't two sides to the environmental story, that also politicians put them more on the forefront. And in the end, what changes that is the actions of the public. What the Sierra Club is doing, what grassroots organizations are doing, are really forcing the political establishment to put these issues in the forefront.
How do you think we can make sure that voters actually see the connection between global warming and this opportunity to reinvigorate our economy with green jobs and clean jobs?
Well, I think that the public recognizes increasingly, and I think, as you're right, a lot of more work has to be done, that if we could invest actually into renewables, if we can invest into energy sources that do not make us dependent on oil shakes and countries that support terrorism, then not only would the environment benefit, the economy benefit, but also our national security would benefit. So it's one of those issues where if you connect the dots for the public, it's not difficult to see. I mean, we started back in 2001 with something that we're calling the Detroit Project that is really critical to what has happened since in terms of connecting the dots between national security and our oil consumption at home.
And when you ran against Arnold Schwarzenegger for governor, I remember that you described your candidacy as the hybrid versus the Hummer. So talk to us a little bit more about that Detroit project and how you're trying to promote fuel economy and hybrid cars.
Yes, that was kind of one of the funny aspects of the campaign. We had this little piece of animation with me in my hybrid and him in his Hummer. I actually myself switched to my hybrid in 2001 from a Lincoln Navigator. So I was somebody who kind of saw the light. I was helped by my friends like Lori David, with whom I actually co-founded the Detroit Project. But I saw that becoming part of the understanding of a lot of my friends, and gradually spreading. So now you have to be on a waiting list to get a hybrid, a Toyota Prius, and a car that cost just over $20,000 became a status symbol, became a symbol of people understanding what it means to be driving a socially responsible car. And also, you know, one of the problems I'm having with my car is forgetting to put gas in it because I put gas in it so rarely.
Well, you talked about seeing the light, and I guess some would hope that that applies not only to switching cars but also to switching political visions or affiliations. How do you think we can encourage people who have not seen the light to understand that environmentalism is not all about gloom and doom but is actually about, you know, working together and positive future and actually thinking about what we want for our children?
Well, that's where the work that the Sierra Club is doing, the work that the Apollo Alliance is doing, is so important, because it's not just about what we are against, it's about what we are for. It's about looking forward to an economy that is based on renewable energy, building houses that are based on green technologies. And all that is now available. And it's actually really exciting when you see how much is available and how differently we can lead our lives and do our business.
Here's something I've actually been thinking about a lot. I remember, you know, in your Republican days, you were a big believer in the Gingrich Revolution. And I read that Al Franken once said about you, "Ariana took the mission very seriously, but soon discovered that the Gingrich Republicans did not." Do you think that the Republicans of 2009 will be any less of an obstacle to a Democratic administration with a progressive agenda than they were in the 90s?
You know, what I actually say in this new book is that the right is increasingly taking over the mainstream Republican Party. Unfortunately, the extremists have prevailed. I mean, we see now that Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham are actually arguing even against John McCain, even though John McCain is hardly the moderate the media are still presenting him to be. And they feel they have such a stranglehold on the party that they can make those claims and those attacks. And that's really what has happened. That's the big difference in the way that the lunatic fringe of the right took over the Republican Party and indeed America. I mean, it is amazing that we are debating torture, that we are having candidates until recently like Mitt Romney talking about doubling Guantanamo, that we are accepting wiretapping of citizens. You know, that's all these things, you know, seem really beyond the pale, and yet they've become part of our mainstream debate. And that's why this is a moment where we can really turn a page.
Speaking of mainstream, you travel all over America for your speaking engagements. And I'm just wondering, what are some of the most common concerns and questions that you get from Americans, and how much do they actually vary geographically?
Well, I think that there are two major concerns. One is national security, and it's linked to our presence in Iraq. And the other is healthcare. I mean, healthcare is the paramount domestic concern, without question. There's nothing really more scary for people than to be left without health insurance. And increasingly now, of course, we have the concern about housing and foreclosures, you know, over 2 million foreclosure notices last year. So it's a time of real economic crisis for many people. At the same time, the people at the top, even if their companies are failing, are ending up with massive bonuses and multi-million dollar golden parachutes.
I'm curious, what advice would you give the Sierra Club to ensure that we remain a relevant and potent force for the next 20 years or more?
Well, the first thing is national security. I think America, who has been revered and idealized abroad, and, you know, I was born in Greece and I grew up with this reverence for America, is now going through a very difficult patch, partly because of our presence in Iraq, where we've been seen as an occupying force, where Abu Ghraib has taken us off the high moral ground. All those are very, very important matters that we need to fix and we need to change. And that's part of why this next election is so significant.
What's it like to be a strong woman in this old boys club of politics?
I think it's great. I don't see any disadvantages in the work that I do, in the world of media. I think we women have more problems in dealing with power and being comfortable with influence and having our voices heard. And I see that with my teenage daughters. I see that with a lot of my younger friends, strangely enough, even though supposedly we've made so many inroads and so many victories in this arena.
You know, you mentioned your book, Becoming Fearless, and one of your trademark traits is this ability to just jump in and try new things. So you've switched political parties, you've run for governor, you even wrote a political comedy show for Comedy Central. Is there anything out there that you're still afraid of?
My fears right now center very much around my children, and I'm working with that. You know, as a mother, you feel very vulnerable as your children become teenagers. One of them is going to college next year. So there's that constant effort on my part not to move into negative fantasies, you know, if my daughter is 15 minutes late coming back from her curfew or any of those things. So these are the fears I'm dealing with now.
And what about fears, things that might keep you up at night in terms of our country?
Well, for me, what keeps me up at night in terms of our country is Iraq. I'm a complete believer that our continuous presence in Iraq is hurting our country, is hurting our national security, is making us less safe, and is not really leading to greater political stability in Iraq. So I hope the next president will bring the troops home quickly and try and do something more in Afghanistan, which is falling apart while we have taken our eye off the ball.
Now, you probably know the Sierra Club has been around since 1892, so we're one of the oldest and the largest grassroots group in the country. With your bird's eye view of politics and of America, what advice would you give to the Sierra Club to ensure that we remain a relevant and potent force for the next 20 years or even longer?
Well, the Sierra Club has won many victories and is now mainstream. You know, I think what is interesting is that a lot of these ways of looking at the Sierra Club or looking at many other political issues through the left-right prism are now obsolete. So to look at the Sierra Club as a left-wing organization, for example, as many still do, is really, for me, a completely distorted view of where the Sierra Club is, which is completely mainstream. And I think it's very important to say that, because when we present issues, including environmental issues, as right-left, then people think, well, it's somewhere in the middle that the truth and the sensible solution resides. And that's just not true. You know, often sensible solutions are on one side or the other. They are not in the middle. And I think the Sierra Club needs to make that point clearly when it comes to environmental issues.
Any words of wisdom for our listeners who might be just starting out in their political involvement?
This is a great year to be starting out in politics. It's an exciting year, amazing turnouts, unprecedented numbers of young people getting involved, a lot of unlikely voters becoming likely voters. It's really exciting.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
Thank you so much for having me on. I look forward to coming back.
Great. Well, Ariana, thanks so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Time out now for Ask Mr. Green. Alberta in Anchorage, Alaska writes, I like to turn off all the lights when I'm not using them, but my husband prefers to leave certain ones on at all times, even at night. He says it wastes more energy to turn fluorescent lights off and on than it does to just leave them on. Please let us know who is right. We promise we will follow your advice. Great question there, Alberta, and thanks for providing this fine opportunity to burnish my feminist credentials by resolving a dispute in favor of a woman. Yes, it does take a surge of current to turn on a fluorescent light, but urban legend has exaggerated that into a veritable lightning bolt hurled from a mile-high drill rig. In fact, the extra juice needed to ignite the bulb only flows for a fraction of a second and draws as much extra current as the bulb would consume in about 5 seconds of operation. So the single easiest and simplest piece of environmental advice is as true as when your great-grandma first uttered it. Turn off the lights. Frequent on-off switching does, however, slightly diminish the life of the bulb. For maximum cost effectiveness, a good rule of thumb is to turn off the lights in a room you'll be leaving for 15 minutes or longer. Otherwise, turn them off.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
There's a place where a total stranger will give their blood to save your life. There's a place where someone you never knew will save your child from drowning. A place where people will give you food and shelter after a flood. There's a place where, when you need it most, someone will reach out their hand, put it across your shoulder and say, everything's going to be okay. That place is called America, where we look out for each other. And it's up to us to keep it that way. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org today.
The Trade and Apprentice Education Division of the Henry Ford Community College is excited to present a new 10-credit-hour renewable energy certificate program. The content of the courses will be structured to inform the students of both present and future renewable energy concepts. This certificate program should interest students who are looking for an alternative to our current reliance on fossil fuels. To learn more about this program, please contact the Trade and Apprentice Education Division at 313-845-9609 or on the internet at www.hfcc.edu.
Wonder about such things as dreams, astrology, reincarnation, or other supernatural topics? Well, if you do, be sure to listen to Metaphysically Speaking every third Saturday of the month at 10 a.m. I'm your host, Mike Holloway, hoping you can join me for each edition of Metaphysically Speaking, only on WHFR.FM, the station that is truly making waves.